My guest on The Sound of Young America is Rob Bowman. He's the author of Soulsville, USA, The Story of Stax Records, and he's also one of the commentators on the newly released DVD of the film Watt Stax. Now, Rob, let's start with this. For people who think of soul music in terms of maybe Motown Records and Detroit, or they don't necessarily understand the context of Stax, let's put Stax in a little bit of historical context for folks.
Sure. Stax Records was an entity that existed in Memphis, Tennessee, basically 1960 to 1975. Stax was the home of artists like Booker T and the MGs, Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Eddie Floyd, William Bell, Johnny Taylor in the 1960s. And as such, if you think about it, especially in contrast to the sound of Motown up in Detroit, the sound of Stax was the blueprint for the sound of Southern soul music. You know, Stax developed an identifiable sound. Within two or three bars, you could tell a Stax record in the 1960s, and that's because they were using one band. Booker T and the MGs were backing up all the artists I just named. They were recording in one studio, and it was a particularly unique, handcrafted studio. It was an old abandoned movie theater that they simply ripped all the seats out, never leveled the floor. Consequently, you had no parallel surface between floor and ceiling, because the walls came in at an angle. You had no parallel surfaces with the walls, which gave you a really live, reverberant sound, totally unlike any other recording space I have ever been in. Given that, and given that that was starting as early as 1960 with Rufus and Carla Thomas's hit, 'Cause I Love You, the sound of Stax, as I said, became a blueprint for Southern soul music. When you hear Aretha Franklin in 1967 record her first soul records as opposed to her pop material that she'd done earlier for Columbia, you're really hearing the sound of Stax through non-Stax hands and vocal cords. Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour came out on Atlantic Records, was actually recorded at Stax, and that record, probably alongside Otis's big hit such as Respect and I've Been Loving You Too Long, really takes that sound and makes it have an inordinate influence on soul music artists all across the United States.
Tell me a little bit about the start of the story of Stax Records.
Well, I often say the story of Stax is stranger than any fiction writer could have concocted. Stax was started by a white country fiddler named Jim Stewart, who by his own admission knew nothing and cared nothing about black music. So how did this gentleman end up starting this incredible soul label? He thought he was starting a country and pop label, in many ways an emulation of what Sam Phillips had done at Sun Records in Memphis. And of course, most people know Sun as the home of Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and so on. Well, Jim recorded, I think it's 11 country and pop records. All of them were pretty dire, except for one, you know, obscure rockabilly record. Great record, but didn't sell anything. And Jim was close to bankruptcy. He had rented this movie theater that he had reconditioned into a recording studio. It happened to be in a neighborhood that was slowly changing from white to black, as is a very common story in terms of urban America's neighborhood shift, and the racial tensions that have pervaded much of the history of that country play their part in terms of demographics changing. Consequently, Jim finds himself with a company in what's becoming a black neighborhood, and of course people hear this recording studio, they knock on the door. Jim has not been making any money, he's close to bankruptcy, and he figures, what the heck? And he decides to record Rufus Thomas, who was a local DJ, on WDA in Memphis, and his daughter Carla doing the song called 'Cause I Love You. And as opposed to his first 11 recordings that had completely flopped and made no money at all, 'Cause I Love You becomes a regional hit. Enough so that Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records in New York City hears of it and flies down to Memphis to pick up national distribution rights, gives Jim Stewart a check for $1,000, which at that point in 1960, given where Jim was at with his company, was like manna from heaven. It was like winning the lottery. Suddenly Jim was in the record business for real, and as he saw it, it's like a light went off. Suddenly black music became his future. And I'll just throw this in. You know, Jim's very candid about how he stumbled onto this. It was not by design. He knew nothing, cared nothing about black music prior to this. But to his credit, and I have testimony from tons of black musicians, black business people at Stax and so on, Jim became so imbued with the sound of African-American music, in a funny way, he became the person at the company most entrenched in keeping a black perspective. And it was really interesting. By 68, Stax is co-owned by a black executive named Al Bell. Al Bell really wants crossover success. He wants to change the sound of Stax so it'll sell to more white people on pop radio. And Jim Stewart, you know, to heck with this. He wanted to keep that original sound that the label had forged. It's a really funny kind of story.
Let's take a listen to a classic Stax soul cut. This is Booker T and the MGs with Hip Hugger from 1967. Let's talk a little bit about Booker T and the MGs, who in various compositions were the house band for Stax Records. What role do they play in the story?
Oh, Booker T and the MGs are really, really seminal to the sound of Stax in the 1960s. About, I guess now, 13, 14 years ago, I put out a 9-CD box set that I co-produced on Atlantic, which was called The Complete Stax Volt Singles, 1959 to 68. And, you know, it was everything the company had put out. I often tell people it's really a 9-CD Booker T and the MGs box set with a lot of guest vocalists. And the guest vocalists just happen to have names like Otis Redding and Sam and Dave. Meaning that Booker T and the MGs, yes, were artists unto themselves and had great instrumental hits like Green Onions and Hip Hugger, but they were primarily used as the house band at Stax. And it's really interesting in that they're an integrated band. And when they first started, it was three black people, one white person. By 64, the one personnel change occurred. It became two black people, two white people. This is an integrated ensemble in Memphis, Tennessee, at the height of segregation and in the midst of all the insanity and violence of the civil rights era. In many ways, Stax was an oasis of racial sanity in a world that surrounded it that was increasingly insane. I sometimes refer to Stax Records is the organic manifestation of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. If you think about it, busing in America did not work. Neither black nor white people particularly reacted well when they were forced to integrate in one form or another. Here, though, at Stax, you had black people and white people, certainly at the level of company employees, but right down to the level of the house band at the studio, who came to work every day for a common goal. Not because anybody coerced or pressured them to do so, but because they were absolutely in love with what they were doing. That is the organic manifestation of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. Steve Cropper, the guitarist in Booker T and the MGs, told me that going to work at Stax was like going to church every day. It was this magical, magical, special place. And the MGs were at the center of all of that.
So Stax Records, in a certain way in the 60s, defines what soul music is, or at least Southern soul music. In the mid-60s, Al Bell enters the picture. Tell me a little bit about how he changes Stax Records.
Al Bell is a fascinating individual. He was a black radio disc jockey who, for a while in his career, had been in Memphis before moving on to Washington, D.C. While in Memphis, he'd been very supportive of Stax and, of course, had forged relationships with people at the company. And he continued those relationships up in Washington, played a lot of Stax material, and helped break many hits for the label on the East Coast. In 1965, Stax had got to the point where they decided they needed a national promotion man. And Al Bell was who they tapped to do it. Bell was perfect for this. He'd been a DJ, had lots of contacts out there in the world of radio, understood how to talk to these guys. But beyond that, he had an incredible amount of energy and was a very driven individual. Booker T. Jones of Booker T. and the MGs told me that in a way, Al Bell was the front office version of Otis Redding. He had that kind of charisma. He could walk into a room and simply light it up. Jim Stewart had developed Stax into a very, very successful mom-and-pop or cottage industry soul music company. When Al Bell came there in 65 as the promotion man, he didn't just do promotion. He got into marketing, got into sales. He eventually became vice president and co-owned the company by 68. And in fact, by 72, he buys Jim Stewart out and totally owns the company. Al Bell immediately changes the focus of the company. They'd been all about singles up to that point. I think they'd done 28 albums for their first 5 years. Al Bell has them do 40 albums in the next couple of years. He shifts it not just from 45s, but to become 45s and albums. He starts a gospel label. He starts a pop label. He creates another label called Enterprise Records, which eventually becomes the home of Isaac Hayes. But initially, well, it was always partially for Isaac, but it was also for jazz and country recordings. He eventually starts a comedy label. Al Bell had big visions for Stax Records, and those visions involved expansion in all fronts. He was the black executive who would argue about Jim. He was the one who wanted to make the records, if you will, more accessible to a pop or white audience, whereas Jim didn't really care about that. It's very, very interesting. The black guy arguing for crossover success with white people, and the white guy arguing, who cares a damn about white people? Let's keep this sound pure. In any event, Al had an inordinate influence on the company. Co-wrote songs like I'll Take You There by the Staple Singers, Hard to Handle by Otis Redding, so he had a creative role as well. Ends up producing all of the Staple Singers' hits in the 70s, which in addition to I'll Take You There, include things like Respect Yourself, Touch a Hand, Make a Friend. Produces or co-produces Isaac Hayes' breakthrough record, Hot Buttered Soul, which has Walk On By, and By the Time I Get the Phoenix on it, and is an album that more than anything changes the future of black music in the United States for all of the 1970s. Al Bell's contribution is impossible to overemphasize and exaggerate. And when we're talking about the Watt Stax DVD that has just come out, Watt Stax was at this festival, August 20th, 1972, in Los Angeles. Now, though the idea originated with an employee of Al Bell's, it was Al Bell who took that vision to greater heights, if you will, and made Watt Stax into this astonishing event in the history of black America entertainment, and turned it into one of the most innovative documentary films I've ever had the pleasure of seeing.
Let's talk a little bit about Watt Stax. The event and the film. Where did the idea come from, and how did it generate?
Okay, well, Stax had established a West Coast office, part of Al Bell's expansion plans. Being a label in the 60s, so rooted in Southern soul, Stax sold really well in the South, in the Midwest. They did not do very well on the West Coast and the Northeast. Areas of the company or the country at the time that considered themselves a little more sophisticated, a little more distant from Southern roots. And we're talking about a United States of America that was much more regional than it is now. At least in terms of how radio worked and how records were distributed and bought and sold. So part of opening this branch of Stax on the West Coast was to try to break that down, was to, make connections with black radio on the West Coast, and white radio for that matter, to find West Coast artists, to increase Stax's, base of natural talent resources. It was also to get into the world of film. Al Bell had been to Spain, to Mallorca, Spain, and he'd been to a trade show there, and Philips had demonstrated video. And Al Bell began to realize that cable TV was coming. There was going to be these channels promotional videos would be a natural promotional tool for music companies. We're talking about 1971. He's got these ideas in place. And he realizes that if Stax is going to be ready for this revolution, they need to start building up a repertoire of video, and they need people with film talent. So he forms Stax Films to tie that into the West Coast operation. Plus, he shoots a couple of very early, in fact, maybe the earliest, amongst the earliest, they're not the earliest, actually, but amongst the earliest, black promotional videos, if you will, MTV kind of three-minute clips. So one of his employees on the West Coast comes up with this idea when he's approached by the Watts Summer Festival, perhaps putting an artist or two to play a benefit for the Watts Summer Festival in 72. The employee thinks, why not do a sort of festival like a black Woodstock? Takes the idea to Al Bell, who loves that, and decides, let's have every single artist currently signed to Stax Records play this event for free. Stax will underwrite all of those costs. We'll try to get a corporate sponsor and eventually get Schlitz Beer to underwrite other costs. We'll put it in the Los Angeles Coliseum. We'll have 100,000 African-American people in one place. And if you think about it, that had not occurred before except at a civil rights demonstration ever. This is the largest gathering of African-American people in a secular space and place outside of civil rights. And he does that deliberately with all black security completely unarmed, partially making a statement because of the negative image that African-American people have often received in the hegemonic media in terms of violence and so on. Al Bell was wanting to make a political statement, 100,000 African-American people to get together, and there's not a single bit of trouble. This is a peaceful celebration of expressive culture within this community. Now, of course, it's a great concert. It's an amazing concert. But it's tied to the Watts Summer Festival, which was an annual event, partially to raise money for the community around Watts, and partially to celebrate and remember what people within the black community don't call the Watts Riots, but call the Watts Rebellion of 1965. Which was one of the first times in the United States that there was a huge insurgency within the inner city communities, and we had, you know, the whole burning and thing that, again, some people call riots and other people call a rebellion. So this is a politically charged event besides being an incredible concert. And Bell, of course, thinks, not only let's stage it and we'll give all the money to the local community, but let's film it. And it can accomplish a whole bunch of things. Can help break Stax on the West Coast, part of his goal in opening that West Coast office. It can create the first film for Stax Films, give experience and have an item that both of the film and in terms of the spin-off soundtrack LPs can cross-promote Stax artists every which way. And when the film came out, Stax very much tried to market it not just to the black community, but to the white community through Hip FM rock radio at the time.
My guest on The Sound of Young America is Rob Bowman. He's the author of Soulsville, USA, The Story of Stax Records, as well as one of the commentators on the newly released remastered version of the classic soul documentary, Watts Stax. Let's listen to a track from the Watts Stax soundtrack, which has also been remastered and re-released. This is the Rance Allen Singers.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get together and give a great big round of applause to some new members of the Stax Folk family that you'll be hearing a lot of. The Rance Allen Singers. Come on. Ah! Blackfin!
You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest is Rob Bowman. He's the author of Soulsville, USA, the story of Stax Records. He's also one of the DVD commentators on the newly released and remastered DVD of Watt Stax, an early 1970s concert film and documentary about Stax Records. Now, Rob, one of the interesting things to me about this film is that it not only encompasses these amazing characters from the music, people like, you know, Rufus Thomas and the Barr Kays and Isaac Hayes, but also these other people that are also amazing characters, people like the Reverend Jesse Jackson and relatively young Richard Pryor, all of whom have this kind of intensity and vibrancy that feels like it's almost, you know, 12 out of 10.
Oh, yeah, it's palpable. You get a sense very, very clearly how important this event is, how special this event is for all the participants, but for the community as well. It's not just the names that you refer to, you know, whether it's Richard Pryor, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Melvin Van Peebles, or some of the big Stax artists like Isaac or the Dramatics or Johnny Taylor. Part of it is the cutaway shots of people in the audience. You see anonymous women and men who have these expressions on their face, who are wearing these incredible clothes, and being the early 70s, the clothes are pretty outlandish on a lot of people, who have these incredible natural haircuts, some of them take, you know, going halfway up to the sky. And it is a cast of both known and unknown characters who collectively emit or evoke this vibrancy, this joy, this pleasure in A, being alive, and B, being alive in the presence of such incredible music and such a rich, vital culture. The film captures that in a way that very, very few music films do. And, you know, for those who haven't seen the film, they may be going, well, what's Richard Pryor doing here? Richard Pryor ends up making his breakthrough album for Stax, by the way, for Stax's comedy label. That Nigger's Crazy. It eventually comes out of Warner Brothers after Stax goes bankrupt, but it was initially released on Stax on the comedy label Partee. Pryor sort of functions as this Greek chorus. He keeps coming back into the film at various parts doing monologues. And if you look at the film, it's a brilliant film, and for years, by the way, was used by a lot of film schools when they teach documentary technique, because the film takes a song that we'll see on stage. We'll see part of the song on stage. And it will then take what that song is about, sometimes lyrically in terms of love relationships, sometimes in terms of the genre of the song. So it's when Albert King's playing a blues, I'll Play the Blues for You. Takes the song and uses it as a jumping off point for Richard Pryor monologue on that aspect of African-American life that ties to whatever the song is about. Then we'll often cut to simply B-roll of scenes within the community that in one way or another also dramatize or connect to the song's lyrics, and very often has a number of what I call man-on-the-street interviews, where there are people who at the time were anonymous, although one of them, I can't remember, I think his name's Ted Lang, ends up becoming a star in Love Boat years later, which is kind of funny.
I think you're right, Ted Lang, Isaac from the Love Boat.
Yeah. But at the time, these people were simply anonymous, and yes, they were staged interviews and that they were set up to be filmed and questions were asked, but you get these people waxing on about various issues that, again, tie to the songs. One of them is about love relationships. One of them is about the concept of the blues in African-American culture. Another is about trying to make it in a context where you're a minority community who's suffered from nearly 400 years of institutionalized racism. And what ultimately this film does, and a number of what I like to see as chapters, and I assume, you know, the DVD's indexed in this manner, is through all these means, Richard Pryor, Man on the Street interviews, shots within the community, and then the performances on stage, demonstrate how African-American music, at least as represented by the artists of Stax at that particular time, how much the music is an expression of the lived everyday reality of the community, and how much, consequently, the community feeds back into that music. It's brilliantly, brilliantly done, without a narrator, without being didactic. I have never seen a music documentary, and I've seen virtually all of them because I'm obsessed with music. I've never seen a documentary do that as well as is done in Wattstax. There's lots of great documentaries with amazing filmed music performances on stage, and I love them. But this goes long beyond that.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America on KZSC Santa Cruz. My guest is Rob Bowman. We're talking about the film Wattstax. Now, Rob, there's a lot of amazing performance moments in this film, but I think there are two that really stand out. And the first is by someone who, by the time Wattstax came out, had this long career as sort of a comedic slash serious, ridiculous slash not ridiculous multimedia superstar. That's Rufus Thomas.
Well, yeah, and he was enjoying incredibly in his early 50s an amazing run of hit singles, Do the Funky Chicken, The Funky Penguin, The Breakdown. All these great funk records were being done by this man in his early 50s who billed himself as the world's oldest teenager. Rufus was truly larger than life, and his outfit at Wattstax, my memory serves me well, was a hot pink shorts and jacket with these
those little boy shorts.
Yeah, with these boots that go up to, you know, two-thirds of the way at least to his knee, maybe all the way to the knee. I haven't looked at the film in a while.
There's a moment or maybe like a series of moments in the film where Rufus Thomas is on stage and the crowd starts to pour out onto the playing field, and he sends them back practically with the force of his personality.
Well, what happens is the Los Angeles Coliseum made Stax take out an unbelievable insurance policy to protect the playing field, as opposed to stadium concerts now, where the playing field gets covered and audiences, are on the playing field. The way the show is staged is, you know, a stage was built in the middle of the playing field, but the audiences had to stay up in the stands. And that was really, really important. It was going to cost Stax an unbelievable arm and a leg if anything went wrong with that. And so Rufus Thomas, at the beginning of Funky Chicken, I think it is, has got a line about telling people to come on down and do the Funky Chicken. And people took it literally, and they hopped to finding those barriers. They'd been up there for hours, jumped onto the playing field. You have this incredible sight of hundreds, perhaps, you know, in the low thousands on the field doing the Funky Chicken, which is great in and of itself. But, of course, now we have a disaster potentially on our hands, and Rufus is quickly told that, somebody whispers into his ear, you have to get these people off the playing field, or we have this huge problem. And he does. He cajoles them. He berates some people. He makes jokes. But he gets these people, not using security to, you know, march these people off, which would be the way we do that now in 2004, but yes, via the force of his personality, his sense of belonging to the community, his love for his community, and his community's response to that. They understand where he's coming from, and they all leave except for one probably pretty intoxicated individual with this raggedy umbrella who stays on. Everybody else is gone. And this guy's signifying and parading and showboating. And Rufus just, oh, it's quite amazing. With words only, I'm trying to think of the right way of saying it, but just signifies on this guy over and over, makes him look ridiculous.
Dude gets clowned, I think, and is the way we're trying.
That's a good way of putting it. And eventually Rufus tells the audience, come on down and get this, you know, silly-ass guy off the field. And it's amazing. A couple hundred people come stomping to get this guy. Nobody hurts him, but he gets railroaded off very, very quickly. It's an amazing moment that you're referring to today. I don't think there's a time where the Wattstax concert, let alone film, has come up in all my years of working on Stax, and you know, the several hundred interviews I've done with people connected to Stax, where people, as soon as Wattstax comes up, they all talk about that moment with Rufus. Everybody. Isaac Hayes, he'll talk about Rufus's moment before he talks about himself in terms of that day.
Let's hear Rufus Thomas performing Do the Funky Chicken at Wattstax, as heard on the soundtrack of the film Wattstax.
All right. Here we go. Girl, come on in now. Come right on down front. I got something I want to show you. Have you heard of the punk call? You heard of the dog? But now that's a brand new dance that's going around. And I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the funky chicken. Y'all ready? Y'all ready? Okay, here we go. You put your left arm up. And your right arm too. I'm going to tell you. What you gotta do? Drop your wings. Feet start kicking. Now you know you're doing the funky chicken. Oh, oh. Set the spell. Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready, fellas? Put both arms up. Above your face, knees start wiggling all over the place. Stop your wings, your feet start kicking. Now you know you're doing the funky chicken. Oh, oh. That make you feel like you want to do something nasty. Like waste some chicken gravy on your white shirt right down front. Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready? Y'all ready? Okay, here we go. You work both arms. You work both feet. We ain't together, baby. Right on feet, drop your wings, your feet start kicking, now you know, you're doing the fuck chicken, oh, oh. Come on, y'all. Now here's what I want you to do. Just stand right there where you are, stand right there where you are, and start them arms to flap. Everybody, get them arms to flapping. Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready, fellas? Y'all ready, fellas? You ready, fellas? Hey, do the fucking chicken out. 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 Do the fucking chicken out.
Before we play that cut, you alluded to Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes at this point was really opening up the possibilities of what soul music could be, moving things from the single format to the LP format, going with orchestral arrangements of his songs, and his performance at Watt Stax absolutely matched the scale of that recorded ambition.
Well, you have to understand, Isaac Hayes, for those who don't know, in the 1960s, co-wrote songs like Soul Man, Hold On, I'm Coming, I Thank You, Wrap It Up, B-A-B-Y, Baby. He was a songwriter and session player. He was not an artist unto himself, although he'd always harbored ambitions to be such. Al Bell gave him that chance. The sort of music Isaac Hayes made was very, very different music the music he made as an artist was very different music than he wrote as a songwriter. Isaac, as an artist, reinterpreted pop songs a lot, and then with the Shaft soundtrack in 1975, forged a style of African-American cinematic writing that jump-starts the whole blaxploitation soundtrack syndrome, but also, in Shaft, provides the rhythmic framework for what becomes disco music, which, of course, becomes this massive dominant music in the later 1970s. And I don't think I can exaggerate Isaac Hayes' importance and role to black America. By 1972, he was universally known as Black Moses. I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that the only performer even remotely as big as Isaac Hayes at that moment is James Brown in Black America. Isaac Hayes is the god of black music at that time. So yes, his performance at the end of this day is a huge, huge, huge thing. And by the way, the whole performance is available as a separate CD. Can't remember what we call it. I think we just called Isaac Hayes Live at Wattstax. But anyway, his entrance on stage, introduced by Reverend Jesse Jackson, is something very, very special indeed. It's a moment of high drama. But what's very cool about this DVD is we've restored the original ending of the film. Isaac closed the concert effectively, not surprisingly, when he came on with Theme from Shaft. That was not allowed to be used in the original released version of the film because the deal Isaac and Stax had made with MGM Films for the original movie Shaft was that Isaac could not use these songs in any other motion picture for 5 years or something. It might have been 10 years after Shaft was originally released. And, of course, nobody thought that would mean a documentary with Isaac actually performing it, but that's the position MGM took. So they had to take that out of the original release, and Isaac actually had to fake a performance of a new song called Rolling Down the Mountainside, which they staged on a Hollywood soundstage and made it look like it was done at Wattstax. That's how the film was exhibited from 73 when it first came out to a couple years ago. Now, finally, we've got the original performance of Shaft from Wattstax reinserted into the film, and it's an astonishing, astonishing, powerful and climatic moment that I think speaks volumes as to what Isaac meant to this community, what this music meant to this community, and consequently what the Wattstax event was all about.
And definitely one of the most powerful musical performances I've ever seen from a man wearing chainmail.
Talk about, again, outrageous outfit.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for talking with us about Wattstax.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest in it, and I hope a lot of your listeners get a chance to see the DVD. It's a brilliant piece of filmmaking.
Let's listen to Isaac Hayes performing the theme from Shaft from the soundtrack and the film, Wattstax.
We're getting ready to bring right now the brother that all of us have been waiting for. The brother that all of us have been waiting for. The one we've been waiting for, a bad, bad brother, Isaac Hayes. Shaft. Yeah.
Sex machines are all chicks. Right. Who is a man that would risk his neck for a brother man? Who is the cat that won't jump out when that's what you're all about? Right on. They say this cat Sam is a bad monster. I'm telling myself, he's a complicated man, and no one understands him but his woman. Thank you. Right on. Thank you. Yeah.